The oppression of women in Arab and Muslim societies is a favorite talking point of the U.S. government and often used as a justification for military intervention in countries as distant and diverse as Yemen, Iraq, Iran, and Afghanistan. So one would expect a woman who heads Chicago's Arab Women's Committee, which helps immigrant women from many Arabic-speaking countries learn English, deal with gender-related issues in their families, and adjust to life in the U.S., to be hailed as a hero by the president and other leaders of our country. And in 2013, Razmiya Youssef Odeh, founder of the Arab Women's Committee, which has a membership of over 600 Arab women in the Chicago area, received the Mosaic Award for Outstanding Community Service from the Chicago Cultural Alliance. But in October 2013, Razmiya Odeh was arrested by Homeland Security and is now facing charges which could land her in prison for 10 years and result in the revocation of her citizenship and her deportation to an unspecified country. How did this happen, and why is the U.S. government prosecuting, or some would say persecuting, a 67-year-old woman who has been a leader in her community for over 20 years? Joining me now is Nadine Naber, Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and Asian American Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Many of you will know her or know of her from her work here in the Bay. She was born in San Francisco and grew up around the Bay Area, working with, among other groups, Incite Women of Color Against Violence and the Women of Color Resource Center. She's author of the book Arab America, Gender, Cultural Politics, and Activism, which I just bought, incidentally. And she has worked with Razmiya Odeh on the Arab Women's Committee and is one of many activists who is actively campaigning to get the charges against Razmiya Odeh dropped. Her article, Justice for Razmiya Odeh, for the Middle East Research and Information Project, has been widely reprinted online. Nadine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So first of all, Nadine, who is Razmiya Youssef Odeh?
She's Palestinian, and she grew up in Palestine, and in Palestine she was arrested by the Israeli government. She was arrested in 1969. She was an activist who was part of, you know, the larger Palestinian community fighting for the liberation of their land, just colonized by the Israelis, as we know. And when she was arrested, she was blamed for a bombing. What happened with her arrest is crucial to her current case because as she testified in front of the United Nations in 1979 after her release, she was arrested and blamed for a bombing, and then she was actually tortured and sexually assaulted by the Israeli government. During the arrest, it's important to note that the form of torture that took place is systematic. It's a systematic form of torture that uses sexual violence and targets women's bodies as a tool of colonization. Part of the strategy of the Israeli military is to use stereotypes and Islamophobic and Orientalist views about Arab culture in the torture of Palestinians. And in the case of Razmiya, when she was arrested, what she says in her own words from her own testimony is that once they brought in my father and tried to force him under blows to take off his clothes and have sexual relations with me. And then she talks about how interrogators, she says, tore my clothes off me while my hands were still tied behind my back. They threw me to the ground completely naked, and the room was full of a dozen or so interrogators and soldiers who looked at me and laughed sarcastically as if they were looking at a comedy or a film. Obviously, they started touching my body, she says. And then she says, in my father's presence, interrogators threatened to violate me and tried to induce a stick to break my hymen. So she was shackled naked from the ceiling. Interrogators, she says, tied her legs, which were spread-eagled, and they started to beat me with their hands and with cudgels. So I'll stop there because it's quite an intense testimony, but I pointed out, first of all, to name this as the use of gender violence and sexualized violence as a systematic strategy that the Israelis use in the process of colonizing Palestinian people. And when she says they brought in my father, that again is part of a European and United States colonial strategy that uses these stereotypes, this whole thing about Arab culture being based on honor and shame, and that if you're sexually active or anything related to sexuality kind of can shame your family. And so here, when she talks about bringing in her father, that is part of the way that we saw that, let's say, the United States with the Abu Ghraib torture cases. Similarly, they use this idea that, you know, putting Arab men in same-sex positions, you know, would be the most shameful thing you can do to an Arab, as if, you know, if you did that to anyone else in any other culture or society, that wouldn't be the most horrific, you know, thing you could experience. So she was tortured for 45 days at first, and then she, after the 45 days of torture, she gave in. She says that she felt that her father might lose his life from one moment to the next because the torture he was enduring. He was also arrested, and that she readied herself to make the confession they wanted so that she would leave her father alone. So here is a woman who is sexually tortured. She is tortured into a confession that she has always said she, you know, she never carried out. And after that, she spent time in Israeli prison. She was released in 1979.
And we should just make it clear, first of all, for anyone who doesn't know or doesn't remember, that 1969 was only 2 years after the Israelis occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. What part of Palestine was Razmiya actually from?
At the time, she was from Jerusalem, and that is a contested part of the struggle that the Israelis have always tried to claim, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and that it doesn't belong to Palestinians. And every day they've taken more and more land and continue to do so.
So at this time in 1969, there was obviously resistance coming from many parts of Palestinian society because they had just been occupied. And there was also heavy repression against the Palestinian people. I mean, there's always been heavy repression ever, you know, since 1948, but that was definitely a time of maximum pressure on the Palestinians to get them to accept this new regime. So part of why they claimed that she had participated in this bombing was because they said that she was a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, which they said had carried out these bombings. And so basically anyone who was affiliated with that organization was presumed to have been complicit in the bombings.
This was a period of, you know, where you have a majority of Palestinian civilian society recognizing and rising up against the encroachment and the taking of Palestinian land. And Razmiya was an activist among her people, fighting among civilian society for the liberation of Palestinian land.
And how old was she at that time?
Well, she was born in 48.
So oh, wow.
Make her. And she's originally from Lifta, which is in 1948 Palestine, currently referred to as Israel, a village that was ethnically cleansed by Zionist militias.
Wow.
And she was born the same year the State of Israel was created, which we call a Nakba, the catastrophe.
So she would have been about 21 in 69. Mm-hmm. So how did she come to be released in 1979?
So in 1979, there was a deal. It was a prisoner exchange, and she was released within that context in 79. She ended up living in Jordan. And then she moved to the United States in 1995.
So she originally lived, I think, in Michigan and then moved to Chicago. Can you talk some about the work that she has done since coming to this country?
So in Chicago, especially since she moved to Chicago, she has been working as the associate director of the Arab American Action Network, which is a social service organization in Chicago. And she founded, along with other activist women like Suzanne Adeli, the Arab Women's Committee. And what was really interesting about the Arab Women's Committee, and in my work with Arab women activists all over the United States, to me, this is one of the most grassroots, large-scale, and most successful organizations that provides social services as well as community building efforts for empowering and deeply transforming the lives of working class, disenfranchised Arab immigrant women from, you know, every country the U.S. has been invading, from Iraq and other countries in crisis, Syria, Palestine, Jordan. Women from every Arab country are part of this Arab Women's Committee. And because of this MIA's work, the Arab Women's Committee now has a base of about 600 members. And I'll tell you a bit about how Rasmiya actually built this base of women. She lived in the south side of Chicago, and she would be out, you know, at a neighborhood park or interacting with people from the community. And more she started, soon after she moved to Chicago, she started interacting with Arab immigrant women, and she started noticing these patterns where people would tell her stories about their struggles, you know, struggles with what would happen as Arab Muslim women who enter, let's say, the medical industry, experiencing racism or lack of English language skills in a hospital or at their kids' neighborhood park, you know, feeling attacked by other people or experiencing racial attacks, or someone saying that in their own apartment building, their neighbors were feared them because they wore the hijab. So she, and then people's struggles with their husbands, you know, the typical struggles that happen in immigrant relationships with all the external pressures of immigration, you know, tensions and issues of gender violence that came up. But what she found was that these women had absolutely no resources and no support. So she started going to the phone book and finding people's last names, finding Arabic sounding last names, and calling women on the phone and asking them to come to these meetings. And over time, she built this base of 600 women. And I've been actually attending some of the gatherings and meetings that she holds with the Arab Women's Committee. And it's one of the most powerful spaces I've ever seen, where you see women coming together and who never knew how to read or write. And some of them didn't even read or write in Arabic. And they're now writing, not only writing, but writing poetry, writing plays, performing plays that they wrote together, talking about issues and finding spaces for healing around issues of gender violence, issues of immigration struggles, but also coming together to create strategies and solutions for the problems that they face. So, you know, you would have one woman would raise her hand and say, you know, I encountered this problem with my doctor. And then another person would say, you know, why don't you try this? And then they would all kind of jump in, and they would encourage people who had never shared their struggle before to kind of start speaking about something they might not have ever spoken about. And so you have this incredible space where people would come, even if it was a snowstorm, even if we were in the polar vortex of Chicago this last winter, and many of these people don't drive, and they were coming walking just to come to the Arab Women's Committee meetings. And one meeting I'm speaking of, which was in the middle of the polar vortex, 60 women showed up just to have a discussion about the issues facing their lives. And Rasmiya was leading the discussion, but facilitating, you know, a very collective grassroots discussion and strategy session for people.
And one of the things that I read that she's recently been doing is actually serving as a navigator for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare.
Right.
So
she's one of these people who she really connects the very deeply intimate and interpersonal issues that immigrant women face with the, you know, struggles on the level of state violence, you know, from immigration to racism, the issues of militarism and war and what it means to become a refugee from a country that the U.S. is invading while you're also coming to the U.S. to start a new life. So she has that ability, that, and it's also a feminist framework that she comes from, where she can connect all these issues and the ways that they collide in Arab immigrant women's lives, you know, and in terms of like the gendered ways that these issues play out.
So now she's facing charges of lying on her application for naturalization. She is a naturalized U.S. citizen. She became naturalized, I think, 10 years ago. And actually applied for naturalization considerably before that. The allegation or against her is based on the fact that she apparently did not disclose on the application that she had been in an Israeli military prison. So I guess my first question would be, well, if she didn't say that on her application, why not? Because she had testified about her experience in prison, even at a UN commission. I think it wasn't a secret. So, you know, why didn't she write it down?
Okay, so we have to go back to the fact that Rasmiya was tortured into her confession. When a confession is forced and a person is imprisoned based on a forced confession, we can ask the question, is that a legitimate imprisonment in the first place? And I think the other issue we can consider is that, you know, any torture expert or trauma specialist could tell you what someone has gone through who was tortured, the issues of trauma and issues for anyone who's experienced sexual violence and torture and imprisonment, who's then asked to talk about or document on paper their experience of imprisonment when their experience of imprisonment entailed sexual violence and torture. And the third issue that we need to think about is that we need to ask ourselves what kind of court indicted Rasmiya Odeh in Israel. And this is an Israeli military court that has a 97% conviction rate of Palestinians and provides Palestinians with no due process. So that's the court that convicted Rasmiya Odeh for the alleged bombings. And so her entire imprisonment, again, is based on being tortured into a confession and being convicted by a court that has no due process and is going to convict nearly every Palestinian who enters that court.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael. We'll take a short break and be back with more of my conversation with Nadine Naber. Nadine is the author of Arab America, Gender, Cultural Politics, and Activism.
نحن في حل من التذكار فالكرمل فينا هو على أهدافنا عشب الجليل والكرمل فينا نحن في حل من التذكار فالكرمل فينا وعلى أهدافنا عشب الجليل والكرمل فينا.
Amal Merkus is a Palestinian feminist singer and activist. The song we heard is Diary of a Palestinian Wound, with lyrics by Mahmoud Darwish. We now return to my conversation with Nadine Naber about the case of Rasmiya Odeh.
So now, all of a sudden, 10 years later, the government comes and not only threatens to revoke her citizenship, but actually is threatening her with 10 more years in prison. Why do you think, I mean, I realize that you don't work for Homeland Security, so you probably don't know exactly, but why do you think they're going after her now? I mean, she's been really an exemplary citizen, and obviously, as you've just been saying, you know, made enormous contributions to society. Why do you think they're going after her?
So it's important to note that Rasmiya's indictment follows and comes out of the same context of the sweeping FBI raids of the homes and the federal grand jury subpoenas of 23 anti-war and Palestine Solidarity activists in the Midwest, which happened in 2010. Among those who have their homes raided is Hatem Aboudaya. He is currently the executive director of the Arab American Action Network, which is the same organization for which Rasmiya serves as associate director. So at that time, the FBI collected large amounts of documents related to Hatem Aboudaya, the director, and AAAN, the Arab American Action Network's work during that raid. And actually, just a few days ago, we have new evidence that shows that there is a direct connection between those 2010 raids and the investigation and indictment of Rasmiya. And what already developed with the 2010 raids is that those raids violated the constitutional rights and First Amendment rights of those who were raided in 2010. And so it's becoming increasingly clear that there's also First Amendment violations taking place with the Smiyaudis case as well. You know, people ask, why is it a Smiyaudis being targeted? And to answer that question, we need to look at the United States government's systematic targeting of Palestinians and individuals who advocate in solidarity with Palestinians in the United States. And the targeting of Palestinian activists and their allies has been consistent for decades in the United States. A lot of times people think this started after September 11th, but in fact, this has been going on since the 1970s with Nixon's Operation Boulder, which was in 1972. And I think what is interesting about this case is after Operation Boulder, which was, you know, direct surveillance of Arab activists, especially students at the time, which was in the early 70s, you have this other big case in 1987 where the U.S. authorities targeted this LA-8, which were seven Palestinian immigrants and a Kenyan. And that case went on for all the way till, I think, 2003 and made it to the Supreme Court. And then you had many other cases of political prosecution where basically activists who are fighting for social justice are being associated with terrorism, and especially after September 11th, using the war on terror discourse to associate any support for anything in the Arab and Muslim region as support for terrorism. And what's really important here, too, is that there's a lot of information that's shared between the Israeli and American security services. And another key player here are pro-Zionist organizations within the United States. And so there's kind of these groups that, you know, that work together, share information, and together try to ensure and try to basically crush movements that align with Palestine liberation and social justice for Palestinians. And so her case is a perfect example of how when we work to support an end to the occupation, when we work to end Israeli colonization and apartheid, we need to work to end those things in Palestine, but also right here in the United States, because those are directly connected, the struggles for Palestinian liberation and the attacks against Palestinians and Arab activists and their allies right here in the United States.
Yeah, and I think that that's one reason that the Arab Resource and Organizing Center here has been one of the primary organizers of the demonstrations that are coming up this weekend against Urban Shield, which actually, you know, is this big militarism trade show in which the Israeli government is a really big player. And, you know, so we really see these organizations working together with Homeland Security, with the CIA and the FBI and the militarization of police and all of that, how intertwined it is with U.S. support for the state of Israel.
Right. But what's interesting about the Smiyaudis case, so you had several cases basically after, since September 11th. There's a Holy Land 5 case, which were five humanitarians serving lengthy prison sentences for doing charity work in Palestine. That was a case that was in 2001. And then you have more and more cases that, you know, really received a lot of attention. But what's really important for us to note here in terms of trying to challenge and work in support of dropping the charges for Rasmiya is that for Rasmiya, they're using immigration charge. So the explicit charge isn't, you know, the case doesn't explicitly say that Netanyahu is a potential terrorist, but what it says is that she lied on her immigration papers. And so I think that's a little bit of a shift in strategy, where we've already seen, and, you know, the immigrant rights movement has already exposed how often this happens, where immigration law is used as a tool for, you know, another political agenda.
But of course, that tactic of using immigration to strip someone of their citizenship because of their political beliefs goes way back to the Smith Act and Emma Goldman, and was also notably used in the, I guess, in the 80s against Margaret Randall, the feminist writer who had, because she had lived in Cuba. So, you know, so there is,
that's so important that you mention that,
you know, there is this history, and it is interesting how often these proceedings seem to be brought against women who are very active in building feminist consciousness in their communities. But recently there was kind of a surprising victory in the case, a small victory, but an important one. The judge in the case was pressured and eventually agreed to withdraw from the case because of a conflict of interest. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, so I think this definitely attests to the massive campaign that is currently underway and the massive support Netanyahu has, where people mobilized and insisted that Judge Borman, who was appointed to the federal bench in 1994 by President Clinton, has a long history of activism promoting Israel. He's one of the people who the Jewish Federation of Detroit lauded as instrumental in bringing hundreds of Detroiters to Israel as co-chair of numerous missions. He's chaired solidarity delegations to Israel, and he's also raised and donated a great deal of money to Israel. And so the campaign to drop the charges against Rasmiya mobilized and worked exceptionally hard to, and, you know, of course, the primary work was done by Rasmiya's lawyers, but the result is that the judge stepped down.
And so now what happens?
So now there's a status hearing on September 2nd. The campaign is mobilizing to fill the courtroom and make it visible to the new judge, Gershwin Drain, that Netanyahu has massive and diverse support. What should happen on September 2nd that we expect is simply to learn of when the trial will begin. That's when we'll get the trial date.
And
so September 2nd is a call-in day.
That's tomorrow, by the way.
Tomorrow to call in for information, you just need to go to stopfbi.net, and you can get the information of what numbers to call. And we really need Bay Area folks to really get on board. We have a great deal of support from Midwest and also from the East Coast, but we need to get Bay Area folks especially more on board with supporting Netanyahu.
So that's stopfbi.net if you want to join the many others who will be calling in tomorrow to express support and to demand that these charges, these pretty bogus charges, be dropped and that Netanyahu not be subjected to deportation proceedings. You know, if she were to be deported, which we certainly hope will not happen, which I certainly hope won't happen, where would she go? What would happen then?
If she were convicted, she would serve up to 10 years in U.S. prison and then be deported, mm-hmm. and also face a $250,000 fine. If she were deported, it's not yet clear where she would go, and this is part of the problem and part of the reason why more and more people need to call in on September 2nd is because it's likely that Netanyahu will no longer have Jordanian citizenship. She will no longer have U.S. citizenship. And we don't know if she would be able to go back to Palestine. And even if she was to go back, it would be like sending a survivor of sexual violence back to their abuser. She would be, mm-hmm. you know, living under great scrutiny. Her family would probably be living under great scrutiny once again. she could also be deported somewhere else. We don't know where it would be, but if it was anywhere else other than parts of Canada or Europe, she would be in a place where she doesn't know the language, and she's 68 years old, and she would have to start her life from scratch after spending 20 years building, one of the most amazing organizations for Arab women immigrants, in my view, in the United States and probably across the world. For your audiences, this case is a case that's related to the immigrant rights movement. It's a case about for people committed to prison abolition. It's a case related to feminism and to the women of color movements that see violence against women as a tool of colonization and war. It's a case that brings together anti-torture, immigrant rights, prison abolition, racial justice movements all together. It's one case that brings all of these movements together. So wherever you are, whatever you work on politically, we need you to join the campaign to drop the charges against Rasmia. We still need a lot of fundraising for her legal fees. You can donate at stopfbi.com/donate. Join the campaign. Drop the charges on Rasmia. All out for Detroit on September 2nd.
Nadine Naber is professor of gender studies and Asian American studies at the University of Illinois Chicago and co-founder of the Arab Women's Solidarity Association North America, Arab Movement of Women Arising for Justice, and Arab Women's Activist Network. She is one of many activists working to drop the charges against Rasmia Odeh. The day after my conversation with Nadine, Rasmia Odeh's lawyers filed a motion to dismiss her case based on evidence that the U.S. Attorney for Illinois targeted her because of the legitimate First Amendment activities of the Arab American Action Network. We will put a link to that information about her case and how to help on our blog, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. I also want to remind everyone that the protest of Urban Shield, a SWAT team training and weapons trade show, is this Friday, September 5th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Marriott in downtown Oakland. For information about that, visit ArabOrganizing.org. You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at KPFA.org. I'm Kate Raphael.